Creating access to education, healthcare, and economic opportunities in developing regions of the world where distance is a challenge is the mission of World Bicycle Relief. But what can't be described in a mission statement is that walking is the primary mode of transportation for thousands of people in the developing world. Every day, tasks can quickly become a struggle against time and fatigue. Imagine the challenges of going to school, visiting a health clinic, and delivering goods to market when your only means of transportation is walking for miles and frequently in brutal weather conditions. This next hour, be prepared to be inspired, uplifted, and maybe even stopped in your tracks when you hear from our guest about this organization that envisions a world where distance is no longer a barrier to independence and livelihood. Get ready to learn about the power of bicycles. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as I always do, I thank you for being a part of it. We appreciate it and you. Power of bicycles. What is this all about? What's the need? How does World Bicycle Relief work? Our guest for this next hour has the answer to those questions and quite a bit more to share. Please join me in welcoming Dave Nicewander, bringing intimate knowledge of WBR's on-the-ground operations, implementation environments, and target markets. Dave was appointed CEO in January of 2018, and wait till you hear what he has accomplished so far. In close collaboration with World Relief Board, Dave has promoted a renewed emphasis on sustainable and quantifiable impact, operational excellence, and building the foundations for growth and communicating the power of bicycles and the issue of local mobility. Under his leadership, WBR has already grown nearly 19%, and Dave, you can feel free to update if that's more by now, and equally as important is dramatically expanding access to education, health services, and livelihoods for their target communities. Dave took on the position of CEO after serving for 9 years as WBR's first director for Africa, for which he was based in Zambia for 6 years and South Africa for 3 years. So he definitely knows all the moving parts. And he's been quite busy since taking the CEO role. During this critical time of growth for WBR, Dave helped establish and refine foundational elements of the organization, including establishing their supply chain, designing programs, creating partnerships, coordinating with host country governments, launching new country programs, monitoring results, which is so important, engaging end users, and creating the vision for and executing their Buffalo Bicycle social enterprise operation. Dave, I hope you can tell that it's an honor and pleasure for us that you are with us, and I appreciate your taking the time, given all that I just read about what you do, to be with us for an hour. So let's do it.
Wow. Thank you, Gina. This is a real privilege to be with you today and to all your listeners. It's you sort of make me a little bit exhausted when I hear that introduction, but it's so exciting what we're doing.
It. It's like this dude, for him, sleep is optional. And it's so, I just have to say this, that it's so nice to do a show about something so good and important and uplifting. We get a lot of people on the air that are telling the truth about the state of the world. And I was so happy preparing for this show. It's like, oh, yay, a happy show. I love it. So
it is pretty remarkable what the power of bicycles can do. And it's a privilege every day to work with this organization and with the team that we have and to see the impact in the field. It just changes your life. It just, you know, I wake up in the morning, every morning with my feet on fire saying, well, how can I tell more people about this story and how can we bring this to scale? So really appreciate this opportunity to get on the show with you.
Well, we are thrilled, and so will our thousand of listeners all around the world. I'm telling you, we will SEO the heck out of it, as I like to say.
Great.
I would like you to start. Tell us about the need. I think here in the United States, we get myopic, or we are, not intentionally, but we're not aware of how hard it might be to have access to transportation and how that would impact our lives, when in fact it's impacting the lives of millions. So tell us about the need.
Well, it's fascinating. And to your point, you know, here in the developed world, when we think about what are our transportation challenges, we think about the time that it takes for my Uber to find me, or if there's a flight delayed, you know, and I'm waiting in the airport. And it's very different for the majority of the world. I will tell you, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's over 500 million people that are living in the rural context, that are not living in the urban context, but rather living in the rural context. For those people, the primary mode of transportation is walking. And when you think about that, as far as, you know, your multimodal modes of transportation, when your option is walking or not getting there, it's a whole different world. You are literally chasing the sun every day to get all the things that you need to get done. And that includes taking a sick child to the clinic. That includes, if you're a student, walking those 5 or 10 miles to get to the schoolhouse on time. That includes collecting water from the nearest well that might be 3 miles away. That includes taking your produce to the marketplace to sell. It's a whole different paradigm. And I think it's difficult for us to understand that, to appreciate where those challenges are, and that distance and the barriers of having reliable transportation and what that brings.
And it makes me think about one of my favorite books of late is Paul Hawkins' book about Project Drawdown. And it's another happy story, and I loved having him on the show, but he talked about the top, it was really 90 solutions that are already in place to impact or mitigate the impact of climate change. And in the top 6 are educating women and girls, and empowering women. So it's, you know, all of that that goes with it. So talk about the kids, because sure. Imagine the life of a child who has to walk 5 miles to school in sub-Saharan heat, let us point that out, or rain or whatever, and then they don't just go home and get on their gizmo. They've got a lot of work to do after they get home. So tell us about the kids and what a barrier the lack of transportation is to those kids.
Oh, it's amazing. When you think about probably the most marginalized or challenged group of demographics in the world, it is definitely adolescent girls in the developing world. They are challenged by so many things, including the distance to get to school. But to your point, you know, as they get up in the morning, way before the sun rises, they're collecting the firewood. They're creating the fire. They're washing the dishes from last night. Well, they first have to go collect the water from the distances to for the household. Then they're taking care of their younger siblings, and they're cleaning up the dishes, and they're making the breakfast, and they're doing all these things. And then they walk the 5 to 10 miles that it takes to get to school. And certainly in adolescence, that walk is not necessarily safe. There are dangers along the way. And too many times there are stories of young men and older men giving rides to girls in exchange for. And so these are the challenges that they're facing. And to your point, every study, every simple report and investigation goes to the way to break the cycle of poverty and disease in the developing world is to educate girls.
And
if you educate girls,
yes.
It just magic things happen.
And even though I've been doing this for over 10 years, people still ask me when I'm talking about all of the dangers that we face. We're not talking about climate change anymore. In our arena, we're talking about climate adaptation, because the climate has already changed. But it is really, when they say, what's the solution? And I say, educate girls. That's it. That's a solution, because it's a ripple effect and everybody's better. Even with microlending, the proof is in the pudding. If you do microlending to women, it succeeds, and the failure rate for giving it to men is dramatically different. So
100%.
I'm all on this one with you. So yes, it's great. And a bicycle can really be literally, and I think I read this in some of the material that you sent to me, but it's really like an industrial revolution in one person's life to just have a bicycle.
It's so true. And we can go more into our education program, but appreciate in the context that we're working in the rural areas of where distance is a challenge in transportation, our bicycle that we put into these education programs is the most valuable asset within that household because it is a cross-cutting intervention. It's a bicycle that you use to take your sick child to the clinic. It's a bicycle that you use to take your produce to the marketplace or to get fertilizer to take to the fields and certainly to go to school. In our education program, we tie that most valuable asset to a girl's education. And there's a whole process of working with the community from the ground up to make sure that that's sustainable. But it changes that girl's negotiating power within that family. Within that community. Because when she receives that bicycle, it's witnessed by the entire community. That bicycle is her asset to be able to get to and from school and to continue her education. We have story upon story where girls have been brought back from being sold into an early marriage. And because they were part of our bicycle education empowerment program and they signed a contract to continue school, therefore a head teacher or a deputy head teacher that was able to bring them back from an early marriage. It's just remarkable.
It's such a game changer. There's no hyperbole possible because you can't emphasize it enough. I'm curious about, and I'm so glad that I remembered to ask this, and I have to ask this now while I remember it, but how in heaven's name do you pick who's going to get the bikes when there is such a demanding need? It's like, that's the $64,000 question. How do you decide?
Sure. The need is in the millions, and we have, like any organization, limited resources.
Right.
And sort of looking at, we work very closely with the ministries of education in each one of our countries that we operate in, and we work with partners on the ground to identify the communities, and we work with the schools. And where distance is a challenge, when in the rural areas where distance is really a challenge, identifying those schools and then engaging with the head teacher in that school and the PTA members, because they have PTA members as well, and working with the traditional leaders. Appreciate in these areas, too, that the traditional form of leadership through chiefs and chieftainesses, head men and head women, is very prevalent and very relevant as it relates to how that society operates. So we work very closely early on to get their buy-in so that they're part of the process as well. And that really, really helps as far as the sustainable impact of the program. So they form a bicycle supervisory committee. And so it's typically 10 to 12 people. It will have the head teacher, deputy head teacher, member of the PTA, member of the students, member of the traditional leadership, religious leaders, civic leaders in that community, and they determine who receives the bicycle. And the only parameters that we get, say we go into a school that has 500 students. Well, all 500 students could benefit from a bicycle.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But we wanted to make sure that there was a specialness of what we're doing. We never wanted to be a dump and run type organization. So we bring in 200 bicycles for those 500 students, and they have to determine based upon need. And the need is determined by distances and challenges faced by those children. And so the community has to come together, this bicycle supervisory committee, to determine what the need is based upon distance. So literally it's thinking about concentric circles from the school distance and who lives furthest. And the important part is having that broad consensual process with the community so that there's not a strong man or a chief or a head teacher that says, no, I'll determine who gets the bicycle
right.
and then doles it out
right.
to his favorites. It's a very open and transparent process whereby everybody, and we literally post the people that are receiving the bicycles on the front of the school. So everyone sees that so that the entire community is sensitized. And trust me, when we bring those 200 bicycles into a rural school, it is like nothing you've ever seen. There's
bedlam.
Literally
I wish I could see it. Yes.
You need to come visit.
Yes.
There's 1,000 people there singing and dancing and cheering, and there's speeches by the deputy education board members, by the the chief and the chieftainess and the importance of girls' education and why we're doing this program and that the girls will receive these bicycles. And I have to tell you, Gina, there's nothing like seeing the look in that girl's eyes when her name is announced and she goes up one by one to receive that bicycle. It is powerful. She knows that somebody cares about me, somebody cares about my education, and I'm receiving this bicycle, the most valuable asset, and it's tied to my, they actually sign a physical contract that's witnessed by their guardians, their parents or their grandparents' guardians, as well as the community members. And it's just magical. And so everybody, there's a physical contract, but then there's more importantly a social contract. Everyone knows why they're receiving these bicycles and what their intended purpose is. And so that, to me, is the magic of it. You have to have the determination of the recipients. And but the only other framework, say we bring 200 bicycles, and we say 70% of those bicycles need to go to girl students. And so making sure that they keep within those parameters is an important part of it as well.
I love it. So you're changing the world forever. I mean, this is one of those things where it has a ripple effect that you've changed the course of their lives forever. And I know that from what I did for 35 years in social services. Like you, mm-hmm. you are being the change, and there it goes. So tell us, let's dig a little bit deeper into, I'm so curious to know, how did it start? And then, I mean, seriously, and your innovative model, I mean, I have like so many questions, and through that conversation, what does it look like today? Can you give us some of the highlights? I'm very, very intrigued by this whole concept and how it's working.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. And our beginning stories are pretty interesting. We started as really a corporate social responsibility.
CSR.
I'll take you back to December of 2004, which was our origins. And at that time, there was the Indian Ocean tsunami that took place.
Right.
And watching that devastation was a couple, FK and Leah Day. FK and Leah Day were watching the devastation that was broadcast across the airways and thinking, well, maybe we can do something. And a lot of people were compelled because that was really the first natural disaster that was televised for the world, it seems. And certainly a lot of people were called to action. Well, FK, about 30-plus years ago, FK and his brother and some engineers started a company called SRAM. SRAM, S-R-A-M. It's based in Chicago, Illinois. And it's grown to be the world's second largest, the U.S. largest bicycle component manufacturer. And they make really unique things. Their claim to fame, their first start was something called the grip shift. And so if you remember way back when, you used to have to change gears by, on your down tube, there was sort of a lever.
Right.
And they changed it by being able to change your gears indexed on the handlebar. And that was their idea. And
which for someone like me, who just started riding again, that's a big thing.
That's a big thing.
That's a big deal, because I'm not a cyclist. I'm a bike rider.
I appreciate that. So you want to be able to index, and that was their claim to fame, and they sort of started off with that, and they've grown exponentially since those early days to this point. And, you know, SRAM has facilities around the world, including in Asia. And so thinking we as a company should have some sort of a global response, we have expertise and connections and network within the cycling industry. Maybe bicycles could help in that disaster recovery. And so in January of 2005, FK and Leah's a professional photojournalist. They went off to Sri Lanka and spent some time with government officials and nonprofit organizations working there, and came upon an organization that said, yes, this could make sense. Let's go figure out what a program could look like, and came up with a 24,400 bike program, about one third of them going to healthcare workers, one third to students that were reconnecting with school, and one third to entrepreneurs. So an example might be a fisherman that was displaced because of the tsunami reconnecting with their market in the ocean. And it was almost going to be, quite frankly, a one and done situation. FK was able to work with his vast experience and background in the cycling industry, work within the network of suppliers to specify a bicycle that was strong and sturdy and appropriate for the different area. And Southeast Asia has a very strong cycling culture and quality bicycles, and so was able to do that successfully. And again, almost a one and done as far as going back to SRAM and then focusing on Tour de France type bicycle stuff and stuff that goes on really fancy and mountain bikes and all kinds of things. But what happened was there was an impact report that was done, and it was showing that this is really an important intervention. The bicycles really connected people to the vital resources of healthcare, education, economic opportunity. It reduced the cost of transportation. It really connected people, and it allowed them to overcome that barrier of distance. And so with those results, it was almost a compelling that we have to do more. That transportation, from an individual level, transportation is really overlooked as a development need. And so the first program that we went to and looked at, and it was in Africa after the Sri Lanka, and appreciate that, you know, the 250,000 people that passed away, perished in the tsunami, that happens about every 6 weeks in sub-Saharan Africa based upon disease, wars, issues of could be overcome. So, you know, Africa is sort of the final frontier as relates to really looking at some where the development challenges are. And the first program that we looked at was in the country called Zambia, and it was a healthcare program that was helping combat the HIV pandemic that was taking place. This is back in 2007. And I can pause there and see if I have any questions to date or just
No, that is, I'm losing track of time, which means I'm listening to this story, and it's a wonderful one. And what's just the comment I'd like to interject is the integrated approach from the beginning. Like, you saw a need, and then I start thinking about how just a little bit of money on the big scale of government budgets could just change the world, like, forever.
Absolutely.
So, and I want to know, you have to put in a little bit about your background, about how you came to be, because this is, I don't think this is what you thought you were going to be when you grew up. Looking at your LinkedIn profile, it's like, oh, I wonder if this was in his plan.
Certainly not. Certainly not. So, and
like,
actually,
oh, interesting.
This is the time I came in. But I think it's important to note that, you know, the impact assessment that was done in Sri Lanka, that's really been an important part of our ethos, of our DNA from the beginning. We want to do these programs, but it's really important to measure the impact of the programs and sort of think through what are the things that, you know, how are we going to improve the program, you know, so we can learn from that monitoring, but how we can also be able to broadcast the impact to the broader world. So the first program was combating HIV and AIDS. It was 23,000 volunteer healthcare workers that were volunteering to help their fellow Zambians that were afflicted and affected by HIV and AIDS. And these 23,000, appreciate, Zambia is the size of Texas and about half the population and very little infrastructure. And these people, I call them angels, were going house to house doing home-based care with people that are affected by HIV and AIDS and tending to the over 1 million orphans that were created in Zambia alone with this epidemic. And so you had a lot of situations where there was grandmothers taking care of their grandbabies because that productive middle demographic was completely wiped out by HIV. And so these home-based care workers were having to travel 5, 10, 15 kilometers to get to the different homes to help them with their washing and cleaning and taking them mosquito nets, which is really important as far as malaria, being able to take them blankets, toys for the kids, all these things. It was an infrastructure, but it was that last-mile mobility that was a challenge. Because what we found, or what FK found in Zambia when he got there, unlike in Southeast Asia, the bicycle supply chain was not so super. And so you would have these bicycles in the field. Bicycles were found. and they're based off of a old Raleigh British design from the early 1900s. And the Raleigh, the original Raleigh, was a really strong bicycle, and that could last, you know, for generations. Unfortunately, the suppliers from India and from China have become disconnected from their end user, from their customer.
Got it.
And had cheapened the product along the way. So literally, these bicycles that were available in the market just fell apart. I mean, we call them affectionately bicycle-shaped objects, or BSOs.
Especially for that terrain. It's like it's unimaginable for us sitting here in our air-conditioned homes with, like you said, getting annoyed if Uber or Lyft is late. It's like, hello,
right.
People. There's a little bit different
right.
world across the continent, across
the oceans. And unfortunately,
those
at the bottom of the economic pyramid just simply do not have a voice as a consumer. And so, you know, in talking to the Indian and Chinese suppliers, well, you know, Africans, they don't really care so much about quality. They just want a cheap price, and this is what we supply, and this is what's good. And FK sort of looked at this and said, you know what? We can do better. We can start listening to the end user. We can start building a bicycle that's actually going to serve their needs. And he has the background in engineering and the product development experience to actually make that happen. And so that's where I came onto the scene. So I joined the organization in 2007. It's the story, we could be a whole hour talking about how I got involved, but it was basically I met FK and Leah randomly on a safari in Kenya, got to know what they were doing. I was 15 years an investment banker before.
I read that. I'm like, from investment banker to, World Bicycle.
Yeah. And wasn't particularly an avid cyclist. I'm a bicyclist like you, and didn't have any background in development or Africa. And I went to go to the field with FK in March of 2007. And with April 1st, I was living there.
It does crack me up when people say it was so random, because you know it wasn't. Somebody else had a plan for bringing you in. It's the same thing with me and Mrs. Green's World and the educational.
Yes.
I went to the rainforest, and the rest is history. You know, someone randomly invited me, and I came back and told my husband, I'm going to start a radio show. And we're still married, which is also good. It's like, okay, honey, you don't know anything about radio. So, but then I want to press pause here so that our listeners can get a sense for when it hit me. The bikes were what I call, that you were using, the bicycles were, I call it planned obsolescence, which there is a lot of in our world.
Sure.
Cheap, crappy, disposable. So when in doubt, start building your own. Was that the birth of the Buffalo bicycles?
Yeah, that's what happened. We started delivering these higher quality bicycles into this healthcare program. And about a year after we started delivering, people started knocking on our door saying, I've seen these bicycles in the field. I've seen how they are stronger than the other bicycles. It can stand up to this terrain and these conditions that are just really brutal. Africa probes for weakness. I mean, you have to have a bomb-proof mechanics to make it survive there. And, you know, we continue to evolve that product and continue to evolve the Buffalo to make it stronger every day. But people started knocking on our door saying, I want that bicycle for my program, or to purchase. I'm a farmer and I want to take my milk to the dairy cooperative every day, or I want to take my child to school and I need a reliable mode of transportation. Can I buy it? And so FK and I sort of looked at each other and scratched our heads and said, well, you know, we can't fund this demand based upon philanthropic dollars. We were just getting started really as far as fundraising, and we were paying for 23,000 bicycles going into this healthcare program. And we knew how to do bicycles. Fundraising was a new skill that we were trying to figure out. But what we could do is, with him with his entrepreneurial background and myself with, you know, sort of a banking sense, or maybe there's a way to meet this market demand with an economically sustainable model. And so we worked with some attorneys and consultants and came up with a structure whereby we formed Buffalo Bicycles Limited, which is 100% owned by the nonprofit World Bicycle Relief. So Buffalo Bicycles Limited is a for-profit. It sells bicycles to nonprofit organizations, to corporations, to individuals in the markets in which we operate, so mostly in Africa. And all the profits and the revenue are attributed to World Bicycle Relief, the not-for-profit.
And you have, like, an amazing staff. And I don't know how you did it, but whoever did the photographs for every person that's working there, what it just oozes is happy people. And I'm not just saying that to be cliche. Like, I'm like, at this smile. Look at this smile. So where are you all today? Is it part of the operation is in the United States, and then part of it is in different places in Africa. Where are you serving at this point?
Sure. So starting off in Zambia in Africa with our operations there in 2007, we continue to have ongoing operations there and have about 25 people operating there. That include everywhere from our country director, Brian Munga, who's an amazing force of nature, program officers, monitoring evaluation officers, sales teams, accountants, chief operating officer, who does a great job for us, as well as the assemblers and the warehouse managers and the trainer of field mechanics. An important part of this, and I haven't brought up, is that it's not just about the delivery of quality bicycles, but it's the sustainable impact through training field mechanics and having a quality supply chain of spare parts. So that making sure that there's sustainability in the bicycles and measuring how the bicycles are doing 1 year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, not just that initial delivery. So to get back to a word, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Malawi, we have programs happening this year in Ghana, as well as we've done over 7,000 bicycles in Colombia. But in all, we've done over 427,000 bicycles in 20 countries over the last 13 years. And I would say half of those have been funded philanthropically through donations from generous supporters and foundations and corporations, and half of them have been sold as social enterprise. So it really shows how it leverages the impact of the organization by having that social enterprise.
And you're providing jobs for within the enterprise itself. To me, that was just, talk about a socially sustainable and socially just model. It's like there's jobs here too for the mechanics. So there's the educational component where you have what I would call a very integrated case management approach. How do you decide when it comes to the healthcare worker or a farmer, economic development? How do you, curate that or put a program in place that answers those needs? Because you're doing that too.
Sure. And so taking the lessons learned from that initial healthcare program, that included a service-to-own contract that increased the retention of those volunteer healthcare workers. A typical volunteer healthcare worker in a program like that, you might have a 50% annual turnover, because these are people that are living on the razor's edge of survival themselves, right? They're taking care of their fellow Zambians or their fellow the community members, but they're also subsistence farmers that are trying to take care of themselves. By adding the bicycle and having a 2-year service to own contract, that retention went up to 97%. And so that was much more of a bigger impact for those healthcare programs to meet their important measurable outcomes, because they were able to train those healthcare workers to go deeper and didn't have to spend as much money on retraining new people. And so a lot of our social enterprise, I'd say a good 80% of our social enterprise, is to nonprofit organizations like UNICEF, like CARE International, World Vision, that are doing healthcare programs that understand the impact that mobility has for them to succeed and to meet their goals. And so we bring the lessons learned and the training of the field mechanics and the supply chain of spare parts. We're the mobility experts in these broader development, largely healthcare programs that's been successful and continues to be refined. With the economic programs, you mentioned the dairy farmers. That's a tricky one, because we never wanted to create a subsidy. We never want to necessarily create, you know, you don't want to distort the marketplace as good economist. And so we've worked with the group to have, an example would be with a cooperative, that the cooperative would guarantee a dairy farmer to pay back over 3 to 6 months the cost of a bicycle, and they would aggregate the payments and they would guarantee the payments. And so it was a deduction from that dairy farmer's payment from the cooperative would go to World Bicycle League. So for us, that was good because we weren't taking the individual credit of the farmer, but had the ultimate credit of the cooperative to make the payments. And so we've seen good success and continue to scale that. We've seen that with dairy farms. We've seen that with flour farms in Kenya. We've seen that in security firms in Zimbabwe. So that's a good scalable sugar farms in Zambia as well. So that's a good model for us. We're also working with a great organization in Kenya that's doing micro grants to women that are starting businesses, and we're injecting the bicycle, and we'll have that service to own contract so that there is that tie to the mobility and the impact of the program.
So what I think is, you know, I'm kind of a woo-woo person. I try not to bring it onto the airwaves too much because this is all very real and very happening down to earth. But this morning I've been involved in Rotary for almost 30 years. And of course, our goal was to combat polio. That's what got me interested in the first place. That's why I continue to be active. And at the board meeting, we talked about if our club was going to get involved in an international project this year. And unanimously, I'm in one of the greatest Rotary clubs in the world, and I think everybody probably says that, but we decided, yes, we are. So the person in charge of international projects will be at my house tonight for a reception, and I'm going to talk to him about this, because the power of Rotary in combating polio and the amount of money we have been able to raise, especially from Bill and Melinda Gates, they've given us close to $1 billion, and it's still out there. So this is something that for our listeners, when you think about what could I possibly do, if it's part of someone's corporate social responsibility to give back, this is an exciting program when you know the end user is getting it. It's like, this is what I want to know, that my money is going to go to somebody that's going to change their life forever, and it can be a bicycle.
We are so blessed in that way, Gina, as far as having a very tangible product and a tangible impact. And, you know, that day one, that girl's life is changed forever because she has that bicycle. So it's not, you know, you can do the measurements, and we spend a lot of our time and resources making sure that we're doing as best we can and measuring the impact. But day one, that impact is real. And we've had an amazing partnership with Rotary over the last couple of years, and would love to talk more about that.
That makes me really happy. Of course there are Rotarians that are aware of this.
Sure.
So maybe you can add one more.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Now, another thing that I love, and I'd like to kind of weave in here, you had jobs on the ground. You were boots on the ground, doing things, seeing how the operations work, really being a presence, and now you're the CEO, and I did read that a lot of innovative changes were made once you came to the top job, and that's wonderful. That's what organizations need to do, fresh blood or fresh meat, if you want to call it, whichever you want to call it, but a new perspective. Yeah. How important do you believe these outcomes are? Because that just blew me away. You are measuring your outcomes. Do funders and individual donors, do they want to see these outcomes? When I read something like one of the report you did in 2012, it said 28 increase in attendance and 59 increase in academic performance for students with bicycle. Well, that speaks to me. So are you just staying on top of the outcomes so that you can use that to raise more money?
Absolutely. I think it's increasingly important. I think as you look at the spectrum of donors, there's some donors that just, I'm an avid cyclist. I know what a bicycle means in my life. I can only imagine what it means in somebody's life in the developing country. So let me give you a bicycle and feel great about it. And that's great. But as you get up the sort of, I would say, the level of potentially funding and sophistication, people want to know results, and more people want to know, well, what's the impact? I can see the picture and I can hear the story, but tell me the data. And that's been a really important part. I think what, you know, FK and I bring to the organization is that, you know, bringing the best business practices to development. And by doing that, you have to measure things. And so by setting up the social enterprise and having a profit and loss, and by having the metrics that we were able to measure, we're able to improve and create efficiencies and also be able to communicate the impact to our supporters. And as we want to talk to folks like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and larger organizations, they require that level of sophistication. So in Zambia this year, we're doing a randomized control trial, which is the gold standard of impact in the field with the girls' education program. And so it's 100 schools, there's control schools, there's intervention schools, about 5,000 bicycles. It's a big undertaking, and the end line data collection is happening as we speak. So that's really important information, again, to improve, to learn and improve upon our programming, but also to be able to communicate the impact to the broader universe and to realize that mobility is an important part of the broader strategies of the sustainable development goals, as well as just improving outcomes across the board.
And in light of the UN report that was released a couple of weeks ago, the clock's ticking in terms of how much time we have. But things like this, of educating girls, of helping community healthcare workers make more patient visits, you're literally saving lives. It's not just improving it. What struck me is you're not just improving lives and providing economically possible futures. You're saving lives with the healthcare workers, and even with, you know, farmers are in bad shape around the world, and there's sure. high suicide rates. So being able to have them increase their deliveries, and I just have to ask you this because I'm kind of a visual person, so your website is like a visual delight. But okay. what are they doing? Are they delivering their milk? Is that what?
Yes.
For okay, all right.
Yeah. So you see
I
that,
figured.
And that's it. Yeah. That's a either a 20 or 30 liter canister that they have milk in there. So that
right.
weighs over 100 pounds. And so you better have a bicycle that is heavy duty enough that, that they can travel from their farm where they might have three or four cows. And they're taking that to a centralized chilling center. And they have to do that basically within an hour and a half of milking. So you have to have reliable transportation. And what we've seen with our again, a study that we did at a milk center in Zambia, there was a 23% increase in the volume and the revenue of farmers once they got a Buffalo bicycle, and so as compared to those that did not. And so it was discernible to sort of see that impact that reliable transportation has to improve the health and resilience of their household livelihood. These are very fragile households. And, you know, when you talk about climate change and you talk about communities that are on the edge and the rains are different from last year to this year and, you know, climate's changing around them. If you're a subsistence farmer, that means you're in famine. That means that you are hungry and real challenges and real, as you say, life or death situations is for real. And what I love about what we do is that a bicycle is just a tool. It's a tool for people to help themselves. And so giving them the best tool that we can through our product development, through our program, through our sort of integrated sustainable model, I think is a pretty powerful way to sort of address these challenges.
And it's scalable. That's one of the things that I love. You have this kind of, I don't know what, closed loop where you're making them, you're teaching people how to repair them, you have infrastructure to distribute them, and then the biggest challenge, I'm sure, on any given day is how to raise more money to be able
sure.
to fund the incredible need. I think it's bold and incredible that when I saw on the map that you're even in, like, Colombia and parts of Peru, the need
yeah.
in any of these countries is unbelievable and very hard for us to understand because, you know, when I started riding again, I went down to the bicycle shop and, you know, it was like being a kid in a candy store. And I did not buy one of those $2,500 bikes because I think mine was like $200 used bike because I wanted to see if I'd keep riding. And it's one of the most delightful things that I get to do on a regular basis, especially now that it's gone below 100 here in the Southwest.
Sure. Well, it's that feeling of freedom. It's
yes,
that feeling
it
of
is.
Opportunity. It opens your world.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And I was thinking about another, like, relative to Rotary, we had a group come and ask us to help fund a solar panel in different villages, and it was to help to increase the infant mortality rate, to decrease that, because if you have no electricity and no candles and a midwife or someone trained to help deliver a baby has no light, that's when the complications happen. So it's something as simple as that, that, like I said, we have such a sense of place being here, to realize that you can do a little bit and buy someone a bicycle, and you've changed their life, the life of their family, the life of their community, and then in turn, the world. It's world-changing.
Sure. That's what our hope is.
Okay. I want to know what's next. Is it more programs? What's your vision? Because I know you visionaries. You're serial entrepreneurs like I am, and I already can tell you what we're going to be doing for the next 10 years. So do you have a vision for the future? Because to me, the need will be there, and expanding is great, but do you have anything up your sleeve you want to share on Mrs. Green's World?
Sure. Happy to do so. First of all, to your point, it is unbelievably scalable. And I would say, you know, the approximately 10 years that I was in Africa and sort of starting up the programs and working with our team there for the programs and the operations really was proof of concept. I mean, can we, you know, create these programs and from a social enterprise, is the right value proposition with where we are with the Buffalo Bicycles? And what we're seeing is that, yes, indeed, even though our Buffalo Bicycles might cost in the marketplace two times the cost of a bicycle-shaped object, people know the reliability and are buying the bicycles. And more individuals are buying the bicycles. And so we started rolling out about 12, 18 months ago, Buffalo Bicycle Shops. And so these are 10 by 10 feet shops that are smartly branded, but they sell Buffalo bicycles and spare parts in the communities where we have a concentration of bicycles.
Helps
with the sustainability.
Love it.
And these Buffalo, it's flying off the shelves. I mean, we're seeing some really great success with that. And it's improving the impact of our philanthropic programs because there's reliable spare parts. And again, from a sustainability standpoint, that funding, the revenue from those sales goes back to the philanthropic program. So we're really excited to see that expansion. And the way we're looking at it, Gina, is thinking about mobilized communities. And so you have a community geographically defined that might have a healthcare program that's being run by CARE International. And they have bicycles for this. And there's a school program that World Bicycle Relief is leading with the Ministry of Education in that community. There's also some dairy farmers that have bicycles that they're paying for through a payment plan. And in the middle of this community is a Buffalo Bicycle Shop that has spare parts as well as bicycles to sell, and a trained mechanic that can repair and fix your bike. And so this is a mobilized community that is able to lift itself up and be able to you know, reach all those healthcare, education, economic opportunities, and that makes a difference. So that's sort of the vision of how do we replicate that in the various world. The need is in the millions. The need is absolutely in the millions. And so for us, it's thinking through where can we have the highest impact, where is it makes the most sense for us to implement. As it relates to, you know, there's areas that are conflict-ridden. There are areas of poor politics and economic, you know, nightmares that are happening right now that we have to be cautious of. Do we want to have the best return on investment going into those areas? And also thinking of the third lens of where can we have a social enterprise that can help support the philanthropic? So when those three things come together, the impact, implementability, and social enterprise support, that's where we can have the greatest impact. So we are definitely looking at areas in South America, like Colombia, We are definitely looking at expansion within sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, who knows? I mean, I think for us, it's about telling more people. So we go from a proof of concept to now scale of concept. And so now it's about, and I think this is to your earlier question about me coming from back from Africa, is being able to bring that voice from the field, that impact from the field, and be able to share that to a broader audience. And with our impact reports and our monitoring and evaluation, being able to engage more decision makers and supporters to help us build further.
And when you talk about, I call it the, you know, the green trifecta, people, profit, planet, there's something about a partnership for good. And I'm sure you can tell I spent a lot of time on the website researching things, and we do green teams. We've done them for, I would like to do it all day long. And what stuck out for me, one of the quotes is, it's under the pay away forward partner for good. And I just want to read this because you never know what listener is going to say, I could do that for my company, or I could introduce that to my green team or my, you know, sustainability team, which I'm going to talk to the teams that I run. When corporations are socially responsible and find ways to give back, the organizations themselves realize benefits from their giving programs. And I am absolute can testify to this. Demonstrated commitment to a cause improves a corporation's public image and brand awareness. There's nothing wrong with that. Increases positive media coverage and attracts and retains both employees and investors. And I have seen it over and over again that the groups that I help, that I consult with, we come up with a project, everybody feels good about it. It impacts staff turnover. It increases employee morale. There are fewer days missing. And nobody's actually measuring that. But when you're involved in a project like this, it's wonderful. So we'll be watching. And I encourage everyone to go to the website. It's, if you want to have like some happy time, go to worldbicyclerelief.org and share it and see what you can say. So if you have nothing else to add, which has been a content-rich, exciting, and inspirational show, I would like to have the closing remarks before we say goodbye.
The only thing I would add is that I'm very happy to announce that on November 1st, we will be launching our year-end appeal. And it has very powerful messaging, videos. It's giving the gift of go. And so I think, for like you said, for people to visit our website and to learn more about World Bicycle Leaf, we really appreciate it. And I certainly appreciate this opportunity, Gina.
And Dave, our show goes out on October 30th. So you've got to talk about the perfect timing of that. It's that, that serendipity that I so believe in. Yes, and I will tell our team and I'll tell our social media maven because she's awesome. So before I close, we have two great shows coming up. One on November 7th, which is our local show with Stephanie Vickers and Darian Godfrey talking about Trees for You and Me, an unbelievable partnership they have to get more green trees out on our desert, our heat island, and partnering with Tucson Electric Power. And our November 6th show, another amazing human being, Thomas Lovejoy, an inside look at the United Nations and conservation. He's doing amazing things around the world again. So in closing, I'd just like to add that one of the ways we like to describe our role in this world faced with the ever-increasing impact of climate change is as disruptors for good. These are people who are interested in sustainable, healthy, socially just living and who take action for others to do the same. That is what a disruptor for good is. We believe that to know better is to do better. Historical, globally accepted institutions, systems, roles, ways of engaging in business and with each other that no longer serve the greater good require disruption. World Bicycle Relief is an outstanding example of what that looks like, feels like, and is. They are, without question, doing the good thing, the right thing for every human being on the planet whose lives they touch, and yes, even for all of us who call the Earth home. I ask that you please consider being a disruptor for good and sharing what you learned from Dave today about this powerful and impactful program, even with just one person. Because in these challenging times, wouldn't someone you care about like to hear some good news for a change? thanks for being a part of our world. And Dave, thanks for brightening up mine.
Thank you, Gina. Really appreciate it.
Keep on keeping on. And I hope I do get to meet you someday and not in New York, on the other side of the world. Okay.
Absolutely.
Make it a great, green, sustainable day, everybody. Thank you.